From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We usually save Robin Sachs, the Nothing But the Sachs segment, for the end of the program, but tonight we're going to start with Robin, and we have a special guest tonight. They're both, Robin and my next guest, are legal beagles. One's a defense attorney, one's an ex-DA. They're both TV analysts. You'll see them together on Thursdays on TV Guide News and other shows. In fact, I think Robin's been on TV more than the ShamWow guy, although he's not selling the ShamWow now. He's got this chopper thing that he's been selling, so I think Robin will be doing that next. Anyway, we've got Robin Sachs and Darren Kavanoki are here to talk about all things legal, crime, some of the high-profile cases. Darren, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Dana. Much appreciated.
You know, you've done your fair share of TV analyst work, so you're no stranger to the interview. You and Robin work together. She's been a semi-regular on my program for quite some time now. And what we do is we just sit back and we talk about high-profile cases, obviously Michael Jackson and others. A little bit later on, I'm going to have a hostage negotiator specialist coming on talking about J.C. Duggard. That's a wild case if there ever was one. But, Darren, I want to start with you a little bit. Someone who practices law in California, who also does the television work, and, of course, Darren's website, you can just click on the link in the show notes or go to nocuffs.com. I love that name. And check out and see what Darren and his law firm are all about. And, of course, Robin, you can just go to robinsachs.com and check out her fine work that she does. But Darren, I want to start with you, first-time guest on the program, about being a TV analyst and talking about high-profile cases like this and then being in the courtroom the next day. Compare the two.
It's really interesting. I suppose there, for me, I really enjoy having a captive audience. And so whether it's a captive audience of 12 people who are my jurors in a particular case, or a somewhat captive audience of viewers, although I suppose the viewers have more choice, they can always change the channel, and God knows how many do. But it's much the same sensation, frankly. It's all about performing and coming up with a succinct and powerful way to carry whatever message it is that you're carrying at any given moment.
Robin Sachs, in your DA days, and I think Darren hits the nail on the head when he says a captive audience, you loved it when your audience, especially the bad guy, was captive or in custody. but you also wanted to, and he makes a great point, it's your delivery, it's how you get the point across. If you can't speak well, if you can't deliver your message well, either as a defense attorney or a DA, you're going to be in big trouble, Robin, or am I wrong?
No, you are right on the money, as you always are, Dana. But it's absolutely true. I mean, this is what I love now about not being in front of a jury necessarily, is that I can make a difference without having 12 jurors in a box. I can go do my thing and not have to worry about a guilty verdict or not guilty verdict, but the skills are precisely the same, both as Darren mentions and as you mentioned.
You know, when you use the media, Darren, Joel Brodsky has been on this program many times, actually with Drew Peterson, and he told me very early on, long before Drew was arrested, he said, if Drew gets arrested, this strategy of mine in the media is going to be something that helps. Now Joel Brodsky is before the court saying that his client can't get a fair trial in Illinois because of all the media coverage that he had. It's kind of shooting yourself in the foot to spite your attorney or something like that.
Well, you know, in that particular case, I think the lion's share of the media coverage is not something that the defense is generating, but I'll bet if you follow up with Joel on this, his take is probably that he is just chipping away and trying to get just a little bit of equal time to try and rebut some of the misinformation that's out there in the media. And if there's any way that he can get a fair trial, I bet he'll take credit for the messages that he's putting out there. But, you know, it's so interesting what we started off talking about, this idea of either as a television commentator or a radio show guest or as a trial lawyer, that there's this fundamental skill that you're good at articulating a message in front of an audience. And I'd be interested to know Robin's take. I'm astounded by the number of defense lawyers that I run into and talk to about this very issue who have such performance anxiety and such fear of public speaking that it just amazes me that they go into that line of work. Robin, do you find that true on the prosecutorial side of the courtroom as well?
See, Dana, I suggest a guest, and he now hijacked his show by asking me the question.
Only like a good
defense attorney.
That's right.
It's a great question. I'm astounded all the time when I see young lawyers, particularly both. I've seen it with defense attorneys, but frankly, I've seen it maybe even more often from the DA's office as well, where I would see a young prosecutor who will do anything they can to dispose of a case. I also knew a prosecutor who had a terrible habit of vomiting right before she picked a jury because she was so nervous. And to me, this is a business in which you must feel comfortable not only investigating and picking apart a case and coming up with a strategy. That's all fine and well that you can do, but if you can't take what you have in your brain or on your computer or on your notebook and translate that into a group of people in a method by which they're going to be able to understand, appreciate, and frankly like you, then you're just screwed in the process and you're screwing the system. So I think that there's a misconception in terms of lawyers of what type of lawyer it takes to be able to do this kind of work, and I think advocacy requires, you know, oral advocacy skills.
You know,
and thank God actual intelligence takes a back seat, because as Robin, who knows me, or anybody else knows me, it's a lot of sizzle and very little steak, so thank God for that.
You know, Darren, I want to get into a little bit. Darren Kavanicki is here along with Robin Sachs, and we're talking about being prosecutors and lawyers, and I can talk a little about being a cop and all this sort of stuff in the courtroom. But let's look at the media the way it is now and the lawyers that are on TV. Hell, every lawyer is on TV, ex-lawyers, past lawyers, you guys. Lawyers weren't on TV the way that they are now. So, Darren, you're doing a show like Entertainment Tonight. One minute they're talking about George Clooney's girlfriend. The next minute they're talking about the Michael Jackson case and whether or not it's a homicide. So you've got to keep the public's interest from George Clooney's girlfriend to Michael Jackson, and they bring a guy on like you. And if you're right, if you can't articulate your story and make it interesting, make it juicy, the old saying, if it bleeds, it leads, you're in big trouble. How do you do that?
A dedicated team of writers that are by my side coming up with quips on a it's just kind of dig in and do it. I think some people are more comfortable and have an aptitude for it, and for me, and I know for Robin as well, because I get the blessed opportunity to banter and fight with her every Thursday on TV Guide and on some other shows. There are folks that it comes naturally to, and we all have our skill sets, and I guess my mom always told me I had a face for radio, and apparently I do all right on Entertainment Tonight as well, and Robin more than holds her own in that respect too.
You know, and that's right, Robin. Now that you've spent so much time on television and you're away from the DA's office and you're not held to certain guidelines, I know there's still ethics involved, but you're not held to the guidelines that you are, and you can be more open. At least I've noticed that about you in your TV appearances. There's a big difference now, is there not?
Absolutely there is. That has been the most liberating feel. Actually, I feel like I just got out of custody in some ways. Not that I didn't love being in custody, the custody of the DA's office for the number of years that I did, but really knowing, you know, just 3 months ago or 2 months ago, whatever it is at this point, whatever I said would not only have ramifications for myself, but potential ramifications for other lawyers in my office, the district attorney himself, potentially the county. And I really needed to toe that fine line. And everybody who knows me knows that I'm no shrinking violet, and I have a lot of opinions, and some of which are ones that my colleagues would agree with, others are ones that they wouldn't, and some are ones that the defense bar would agree with, and others are ones that they wouldn't. And now, to be able to be Robin Sachs, an individual, and have my mind and my voice as 100% my own, it is a liberating feeling. It's also somewhat of a lonely feeling, and to be honest with you, there's not that, you know, I have the office to back me up, and I can go run for cover when I say something that may not be popular, and you saw that recently in my article on Huffington Post about The Economist.
Yeah, I
had a, you know, here I am thinking I'm writing this great article and educating people on sex offenses, and all of a sudden I had every pro-pedophile person threatening me and degrading me and emailing me and everything else, and it's like, oh my God, I didn't expect for this to happen, but it did.
Yeah, welcome.
But you know what's so interesting, and forgive me, Dana, for hijacking your show again, but, you know, just, you know, Robin, you just mentioned your blog, and Dana, you mentioned all the lawyers that that feed this insatiable desire on the part of the consuming public to get more and more information about these cases. What really amazes me is how the technology and the number of media sources out there have shaped the way that cases are tried. You know, we were talking about the Drew Peterson case just a few minutes ago, and some of the moves that his lawyer has made to try and shape the court of public opinion from which the jurors will, of course, be drawn. And just recently in the Michael Jackson case, when we have Dr. Conrad Murray, who's obviously the target of this ongoing manslaughter investigation, who puts up a one-minute video on YouTube that really had no substance to it. But the thing that Robin and I were discussing, which I think was really insightful on her part, that to key into the idea that when you put something on YouTube, people are up there making comments in real time. So now the defense team, who may be debating, well, do we put Dr. Murray on the stand or don't we, they're able to look to the YouTube viewer comments to see how he comes off. Is he believable? Is he trustworthy? If we're going to put him on, how do we need to change him? It's just amazing how now the world of litigation and lawyering is so different because of all of these technological advances.
Yep. Compare it to 10 years ago, Darren, and public response and public opinion. Opinion, whether it's hey, you're that lawyer on TV to a client coming in saying, I need a good defense, to you talking about Michael Jackson or Casey Anthony or whoever on TV, it's a big difference now than it was 10 years ago, and I think it benefits not only the system but the lawyers that are involved. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's so interesting. I was just talking to somebody today about the parallels between the Michael Jackson case and Elvis Presley's overdose death. And we were having to scratch our heads and say, well, wait a second, was his doctor prosecuted and what happened? And then sure enough, we all broke out our iPhones and Blackberries and Googled it and found out that there was a prosecution, but that that Elvis's doctor was acquitted. No one's going to have that same wondering a few years from now about Dr. Conrad Murray on this trial of the century, in this very young century. It's just, it's completely changed the landscape. And it's changed the landscapes for lawyers and lawyer marketing. Certainly what you reference about being on TV and having that exposure, it helps a great deal in terms of my business and the practical side of running my law firm, because people get to judge you and decide in real time, again, whether or not you seem like a guy who knows what he's talking about. Or a gal, Robin. I don't need to be sexist about it.
Robin, whether it's Robert Blake, O.J. Simpson, Phil Spector, Chris Brown, whoever, and you start talking about Hollywood, some say injustice, let's talk of difference about these high-profile cases, the ones that we see on TV, most recently the Brown sentencing for the domestic violence situation to John Q. Public that goes in on a domestic violence beef and assault charge. Let's talk. I want to start with Robin from the prosecutor's perspective, Hollywood versus the normal guy, if I can use that term, and then we'll get to Darren and see what he has to say from the defense perspective.
Well, I think that anybody who even suggests that every single case, celebrity, non-celebrity, politician, public figure, you know, regular Joe Schmo, as you say, to say that every case is treated exactly the same is just completely false. Part of being a responsible DA, besides objectively looking at the facts that constitute the crime, we are constantly looking at the subjective factors, the actual defendant's or the suspect's background, their prior rap sheet, what types of weapons were used, what types of injuries. Those are all factors that while we may say, okay, it may qualify as a generic domestic violence case, we're going to look at all the different factors to determine what would be a sentence. And so in Chris Brown's case, had that case not been a public media case, it would be something that all of that analysis would be done behind the scenes. And the key parts to that case would be, on the defense side, would be that this was a guy who has no prior criminal record. That would be the defense's best argument in terms of a lowest possible sentence. In terms of the prosecution's argument for the highest possible sentence, their best argument would be the pictures of Rihanna to show how badly the injuries were. And so then you would decide from the prosecutor role is what sentence is appropriate based on the balancing of a no prior record combined with those injuries. And I think that did occur in this case. I think that the DA's office, as you've seen this being a case where there was no injury or very little injury, this is a case that very well could have been a misdemeanor conviction. However, with those injuries, it's something that looks like, it feels like, should be a heftier sentence. And so they gave him a felony, and a lot of people think, and I agree that a jail time would have been nice in this case or preferred in this case. What people don't know out there in the public is what he pled to is a strike under the California three strikes law that has prior ability, and that's a bunch of legal jargon that basically means his butt is in big trouble if he does this again. And that is not something that on a first time a lot of people see. At the same time, to say that there is no celebrity factor in there would be ludicrous and ridiculous to even suggest or to even try to achieve. The fact of the matter is they are celebrities. And just as if the defendant was someone in the armed services or a teacher or anything else where you'd want to look at the career ramifications and the practical ramifications of whatever the circumstances may be, there's going to be an effect. And the best possible proof of that is if you look at the restraining order in this case, he has an additional little clause or a little asterisk on the Chris Brown restraining order that says, you know, it says stay away 100 yards from Rihanna. However, asterisk, if they are at a celebrity event together, then he has to stay 10 yards away. Well, that is proof that his celebrity is factored into the circumstances of the plea and the stay-away order. And is that bad or is that being appropriate? And I think it's being appropriate.
Absolutely. Darren, your thoughts from defense?
Well, you know, I love these high-profile cases, especially when high-profile defendants get sweetheart deals, because the DA's office will always come out and say, well, we do this for everyone. and Robin, of course, now that she's away from the DA's office, and I'm trying to convert her, maybe someday she'll become a defense lawyer so she can see what it's like to deal with some unreasonable DAs. But, you know, it's like with Lindsay Lohan. When Lindsay Lohan had a DUI case going, it was an open case, hadn't pled guilty to it, and then she gets arrested for another DUI in possession of cocaine, and she gets the minimum amount of jail time, which was 96 hours plus a trip to rehab. Well, I love that as a practicing defense lawyer, because even if I'm representing Joe Q. Public, I want to be able to go back to that court and say, hey, look, Joe Q. Public's got a case that's far less aggravated than Lindsay Lohan's. We want that same kind of a deal. Unfortunately, as much as we all hope that the prosecutors are doing the kind of rigorous analysis that I'm sure Robin did when she was practicing and what she speaks of now, I don't think it happens. And it's a sad truth I think that people get about as much justice as they can afford, and oftentimes the rigorous intellectual work that Robin referred to just ain't getting done.
Robin, and I'm going to give you the last word because we're down to about 2 minutes here. You and Darren spend your time doing analyst work on TV Guide News, other channels, other stations, talking about different stories. There may be a new story tomorrow. All of a sudden, they're going to call you and ask you to comment on or ask you to give your opinion on Robin Sachs. How difficult is it to prepare for something like that? Or are you able to, with all your years of experience, just go in and say, yeah, throw it at me and I can tell you what I think?
Oh, come on. I can't say that even if I really do that. I mean, it's an unfortunate thing at those times where you get a call and you're like, okay, tell me the facts of the case.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like anything else. And it actually, being a trial lawyer and being a criminal lawyer, and Darren knows this as well as you know in this, Dana, is that as a DA, when I was handling calendar courts, and that was very early on in my career before I was in the sex crimes unit, I would literally go into court with 50 or 60 files, and some of them would be preliminary hearings, some of them would be motions, and very often you put them in order as to what the timeline is and what needs to go first, and you're reading the file in the elevator. So you get really skilled at reading facts for a case very quickly and identifying the issues. The one nice thing about criminal law, and probably the one of the main reasons, other than the fact there's very little math in it, why I got into criminal law was there's only so many ways a burglary can go down or a murder can go down. I mean, I can tell you if there's a burglary and someone says there's a 459, which is a penal code section for burglary here in California, I'd say I know someone broke into somewhere, took something without someone's permission. I mean, it's not that many ways you can find a burglary. Yes, there may be some different issues and facts. So if someone calls me on a show or whatever else, it's the same kind of thing. There's a murder, a missing kid, or whatever. There's only so many versions or ways it could go down. So the amount of time for preparation is then going and seeking out and looking for the issues, which, what happened in the investigation, what the timeline was, what are the age of the parties involved, what's the history and background. And so there's kind of a key group of questions that both Darren and I in our head click through to make our first points. And the other thing is, what's different about TV than being in front of a jury is the amount of facts that we're going over, frankly, are not the in-depth details. So you're talking about our soundbite law and order society who's used to, watching a case get, investigated, prosecuted, and sentenced within an hour on law and order. So on a 30-second soundbite, there's not that much depth I need to go into.
Absolutely.
Well, and if you screw it up badly, they can edit it, too. That's always nice.
Or you have Darren yelling at me telling me I'm wrong, so that's fine.
Yeah, you don't get do-overs in front of the jury, unfortunately.
Yeah, listen, you two, I appreciate it. Darren, Kevin Oakey, and Robin Sachs, you can see them Thursdays on TV Guide News. You can pick them up on many different news channels, news shows, commenting about crime today. You can check out their webpages by going to nocuffs.com or robinsachs.com. And I'm hearing a rumor on TMZ that they're going to be partnering up on Dancing with the Stars coming up soon. So I will. Listen, I appreciate you both coming on. Sadly, our time has gone by so fast, and we'll have you on again soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Dana.
Okay, take care. Thanks, Darren. Bye-bye. Okay, that's Robin Sachs and Darren Kevin Oakey. We're going to be back. We haven't had Mark Williams on for a while to talk about the Casey Anthony case. You know, Mark is a radio newsman from down in Florida and a semi-regular on the Nancy Grace Show, and that's exactly what we're going to do is we're going to have Mark on to talk about that. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. You'll know my next guest, Mark Williams, is a radio newsman, longtime radio newsman down in Florida, semi-regular in the Nancy Grace Show, and someone who we bring on from time to time on the program to talk about the Casey Anthony case. Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks, Dana. Thanks for having me tonight.
What you been up to? I haven't heard from you in a while.
Well, there's a couple of things. First off, I finally met Nancy Grace in person.
Wow.
The bride and I traveled to New York City a couple of weeks ago where she came out with her first work of fiction called The 11th Victim.
Yep.
It has leaked up there on the New York Times bestseller list. We went to a book reception and met her and some of the people that I had never met on the screen before that appear in the Anthony saga. And it was a good night to be had. in New York City. Other than that, of course, doing my website called Halifax Area News Watch. Halifax River, of course, is here in Florida, so I've been dealing with that. And, still looking for a job. Can you imagine that? I was downsized.
Well, yeah, that's the economy and media communications today. It's crazy, you know. But anyway, let's talk about Casey Anthony. Something that I don't know if I've ever shared with you, and I know I've shared with my audience a few times, but it breaks my heart to see Tim Miller and the group from Texas EquiSearch going through, and they can handle this, no problem, but the motions about Texas EquiSearch and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if you know, Mark, but I was one of the guys that suggested Texas EquiSearch to Cindy Anthony, and she took my advice and contacted him, and you know, I felt bad ever since, because Tim went through a lot of crap with that, and it's unfortunate, but maybe fill the audience in a little bit about what's going on with that motion.
Well, the latest is a defense attorney on the Jose Baez defense team defending Casey Anthony was at a kind of a pretrial hearing recently, and defense attorney Todd Macaluzzo telling the court that someone else other than Casey Anthony dumped the body of 2-year-old Kaylee in a wooded area after she was arrested and in jail. Of course, you know, backtracking, Casey is accused of killing Kaylee last June, probably, and this will all come out in trial in a fit of rage. The body was found December 11th last year, 0.3 miles from the Anthony household. Now, Macaluso's statement was made despite strong evidence gathered by prosecutors that Casey was the person who did, in fact, murder her daughter. She placed her decomposing body in the trunk of her car and then placed the body in a wooded area very close to the house. And when somebody said that, when I saw that, I went ballistic because of all the evidence the prosecution has, including the Tennessee body lab results showing that there was decomposition in the back of her Pontiac Starbird. It's just unbelievable what the defense is coming up with. They're trying to poison this case from the get-go, and they always have.
Well, there's a saying up here in Saskatchewan, if you pee in the wind, there's another term for that, that will come back on you. And I think that there's nothing more than some peeing in the wind going on here by the defense. But it seems amazing to me with Baez and the, I forget her name now, Michael Bodden's wife, and the other attorneys involved, and the motions that they keep throwing. Are we going to see this trial anytime soon?
Probably not. It's going to be at least another year. It was supposed to start October 12th, but there hasn't even been a change of venue yet. They're trying to poison the Orlando jury pool. There's no doubt about it. So they're doing a good job with that. Of course, you know, the Anthonys made a couple of guest appearances on some of the morning shows, national morning shows, on what I call the Save Me Tour. They're trying to save Casey's butt.
Yeah.
Getting back to Tim Miller, Miller has been ordered to provide names of his volunteers and literally what they did in that area where they found the body or where the body was eventually found. At that time, if you recall, Tropical Storm Faye had come through Florida dumping 12 inches of rain, if not more, on that particular area. It was flooded, and they didn't want any horses or ATVs in there to upset any sort of a crime scene when the water went down.
Yeah.
Tim Miller's a great guy, and with the volunteers, he must turn over some of the information about the volunteers. I think this is going to hurt volunteerism in the long run.
Well, it's going to make people shy away from it, because you come out with the good intentions of wanting to help find someone. Tim and the experts that work with that organization know very well that if you disturb evidence, if you accidentally step on something, like he told me right on this program, with a horse or drive over it with an ATV or whatever, and then all of a sudden the evidence gets, you know, destroyed and never found, then he couldn't live with himself. And I think when he, you know, stayed away from going in there, was probably one of the smartest things he ever did, Mark.
Yeah, and I think so, too, because you don't know what's underwater. For example, growing up in the Northeast, you know, potholes reign supreme on the highways. And if one is filled with water, you don't know what's underneath that. You see a little, some water on the road, but you try and avoid it because you, that pothole may be a foot deep. That could literally destroy a horse, and that could injure ATV riders.
Absolutely. Mark Williams is here, and we're talking the Anthony case. You know, we've seen Cindy and George, and someone we haven't heard about lately, or maybe it's just me, is Lee. What's he up to?
Lee has kept a very low profile. He has not been seen by members of the media for the past couple of months. You know, he was deposed a couple of months ago, and that's been it. He has dropped out of sight. The last time we heard, he was working for an events company, which could have kept him out of town.
When you get back to the coverage, obviously it's not being covered as much as it has been. But once the trial comes, I believe the way that Florida is and the way that the cable shows want to cover this, I believe you, sir, will be very busy probably 24/7. You might even have to go down there to set up camp at the courthouse or something. This is going to be a trial like we haven't seen in some time.
Yeah, and when this story originally broke a little more than a year ago, I was surprised at the intensity. But there's an insatiable appetite about Casey Anthony, her former boyfriends, the murder of her daughter, how dysfunctional the family is, and how should I say this nicely? Dysfunctional, yes. Her boyfriends are off the wall sometimes, but some of them are very level-headed. The defense is going to try and blame this on one of her past boyfriends. You know, Jesse Grutten's name has been mentioned once or twice. I've never met Jesse. I've met his father, Richard, and Richard is an actor. First off, he appeared in some of the early episodes of Miami Vice back in the 80s, but he's also a minister and has held at least one memorial service for little Kaylee, and he is salt of the earth. He is a really great guy, and he's passed those genes on to his son, because his son, if you recall, wanted to adopt little Kaylee, even though a paternity test showed that it wasn't his child.
You know, I've had authors on my program, Mark, that have since written books about this case, and it's not even over with yet. And we talk about and use the term cast of characters, not only in the case itself, but those that have covered it, right from, you know, Leonard Padilla to you name it. This has been something. Have you ever seen anything close to this in all your years of news experience?
Not really, because usually in Florida, and you have the story and you have an arrest in the case, and then within a year or even shorter than that, 6 months or so, these people are either convicted or set free. This has dragged on now for a year and a half. I remember putting on a blog on my website that this has consumed my life for the past year. Mm-hmm. And this was, I think I put this on like back in July, but it's still an ever-consuming story because I'm always on the lookout for different things in it. And when we went to Nancy Grace's book reception a couple of weeks ago, that was a story that dominated all of our conversation.
I think she was guesting somewhere, O'Reilly or somewhere, and he was questioning her about covering, I think it was 158 times or something like that, and she didn't back down, and I give her credit for that because, Mark, and I want you to comment on this, there's a public appetite, not only because, and you used the term insatiable, because we see the little doe-eyed girl, the only true victim in this case, we see the mother who openly lies, we see everyone involved, the parents, the media, the craziness. Why do Joe and Mary Six-Pack Public, why are they so interested in this? It's gone away from that. Now it's Michael Jackson. Next week it could be whoever. You know, why are we so interested?
Well, it's sex, lies, and videotape. Okay, I'm going to put it frankly.
Yeah.
Now, first off, you have this pretty 23-year-old girl.
Yes.
Gave birth to this precocious little girl. Now, the mother And I'm going to use, we use this down here a lot, and we use this a lot. She banged like a screen door. Anybody who came into her life, Dana, got a little piece of the action.
Okay? Oh, my God.
And we still don't know who the father was. We hope that comes out in trial. She has not said, and you have the sex, you have all the lies that she has told everybody, and then you have the videotape from when she was, the day she was arrested, the videotape from the Target security cameras here in Orlando when she stole checks, allegedly stole checks from her best friend. She's checking out everything, but there's nothing for little Kaylee. I mean, the videotape just has nailed her butt to the wall.
I'm curious, because you'll know this better than I, with the judge and those involved. We've seen high-profile cases covered in the media, the actual trials. We look at Judge Ito in OJ, and we look at most recently with Anna Nicole, the crying Judge Seidlin. And now this case will become something, and it'll be interesting to see, because I believe the DA's office, law enforcement, have done such a good job, an excellent job of being professional, where Baez has played to the cameras every chance he could. Are we going to see Judge Ito, Judge Seidlin kind of story here, where all of a sudden, with all the cameras, everyone is looking for their 15 minutes of fame?
I think Judge Dan Strickland in this case, who caught the case, is probably one of the better judges over there, one of the most level-headed judges I've ever seen, watching things happen in the Orlando Circuit Court area. He's not going to let this thing become a circus like Judge Ito did. Judge Ito got picked, got involved in the cameras in the courtroom, and he got involved in the case because of the celebrity there. And Judge Strickland isn't going to let that happen. He is probably, again, one of the most level-headed judges in that circuit.
You know, it should be interesting. It's going to be, I'm not going to call it the trial of the century, because we've got so many high-profile cases going on right now that when they all hit the media, it's going to be interesting. A guy like you, I think, will be very busy making comment on it. Mark Williams, it's always a pleasure, and I've got to give you the award of the week for the best catchphrase, bang like a screen door. You can't beat that.
I've been using that expression a long time, and I wanted to use it on the Gray Show so badly, but I didn't want to be yanked off the air.
I don't think you'd be yanked off the air, and Nancy Grace would probably laugh her ass off with that one. Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Dana.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. That's Mark Williams from Florida. You'll know him as a regular on the Nancy Grace Show and a good guy, commentator, when it comes to the Anthony case. Have you heard about this J.C. Lee Duggard case? Wow, it's something, you know. And I thought I would go to an expert friend of mine, Clint Van Zandt. You know him as a FBI agent, retired FBI agent, and someone who's very well-versed on profiling hostage negotiation, and someone who's held captive like this. And he wants to talk about what's called the Stockholm Syndrome, where it's said that someone who's taken captive can fall for their the person who takes them captive and become, you know, like Patty Hearst did, or allegedly did. And is it true? Isn't it true? It's a fascinating case about this young girl. So we're going to be back here in a few minutes on Scared Monkeys Radio with Dr. Clint Van Zandt talking about J.C. Lee Duggard and that case. Thank God that she's been rescued, but why did it take so long? We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. You know, this J.C. Lee Duggard case, just when you think you've heard everything, thank God that the little girl was, you know, not so little anymore, but that she was found. But we know the story that on June 10th, 1991, the 11-year-old J.C. Lee Duggard was kidnapped as she waited for a school bus just a little ways from home, but all of a sudden now the story has just ballooned into something. And my next guest, Clint Van Zandt, you'll know, is a retired FBI agent, author, security expert, profiler, hostage negotiator. He and I have talked about this Stockholm Syndrome before, and is this a case of that or just staying alive? And it's an article that Clint writes on Newsvine.com. So if you go to clintvanzandt.newsvine.com, you'll be able to read the article or just click on the link. Hi, Clint. Welcome back.
Thank you, Dana. Good to be with you.
You know, I know you've done a lot of TV and you've been really busy with this story and others. Is this something that, you know, just when you think you've seen everything, all of a sudden you see a story like this?
Yeah, it is. You know, we've heard of these stories in Europe recently. Within the last couple of years, there was a woman who was kidnapped by her biological father, locked downstairs in an underground cavern-like tomb where he fathered seven children by her. And we've heard other stories. But, you know, we dismiss this. We say, well, that's in a country where, you know, law enforcement's really not cutting edge like it is in, you know, the UK or Canada or the US or other places. And then these stories of, you know, the perfect victim come creeping back up on us again. But what this story to me, Dana, has shown, as you suggest, 1991, this 11-year-old girl was kidnapped. There were numerous times that her neighbors let her down. She was only 170 miles away from her home. Neighbors knew this guy was a sexual predator, that he shouldn't have children. But, you know, nobody except one neighbor called the police 3 years ago that resulted in nothing. But between neighbors just not making any calls, and between police not handling calls properly, between a violent offender task force not taking the extra time to search the yard, between a parole officer allegedly making visits to this guy's house two or three times a month, yeah, never knowing that he allegedly had children when he was a sexual predator. I mean, this system failed. Our system failed this little girl,
yep,
who's now 29, and her two daughters, 11 and 15, Angel and Starlight, fathered by this guy. We just failed her miserably. And, you know, hopefully it's a lesson to be learned by police officers, parole officers, and neighbors. You know, if you got a question, if there's a 6-foot fence next to you and you wonder what's going on, get a ladder and look over the darn fence.
Yep, you always use your, I call it the spider sense. When you're a police officer, don't get lazy, don't get into a routine. And I'm wondering, Clint, your thoughts on why there was so much laziness in this. Is it because there's such a repetitive, you keep seeing the same guy, okay, you check on him, okay, whatever, and you're not paying attention? What was it? How can we explain? I know the sheriff has done some press saying that they're beating themselves over this, but there's got to be more to it than that.
And that's not enough, Dana. That's
right.
Not enough. Now, we know this guy who had kidnapped this young girl, both he and his wife who kidnapped this girl, you know, he's one of 675,000 registered sex offenders in America. Well, as you know, there's only 685,000 local, county, and state police officers in the United States, and of course, those aren't all street cops or administrators, etc.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't even assign a cop to every predator who's out and about. But what it boils down to is that I think in law enforcement, parole officers, they get so used to taking call after call. All they want to do is go there very quickly, and not all. You know, I don't want to paint 685,000 cops with a broad brush,
mm-hmm,
but sometimes they just want to go clear the call and move on again.
Exactly.
And if it doesn't reach out and bite them in the nose, it just doesn't get handled properly. Now, the reverse of that is that, of course, last week they were detected by two sharp, one a former cop and one a current cop on the University of California, Berkeley campus, when this guy showed up with two of these little girls. It just didn't look right. It didn't seem right. The little girls didn't talk right. And these cops went the extra mile and ran this thing down. Where were all the other officials that could have intervened over the years? And, of course, now they're looking at this guy, the suspect in this this terrible kidnapping that lasted two decades. Police are now looking at him as a potential suspect, as a serial killer, when upwards of 10 prostitutes and young girls were kidnapped off the street, murdered, and the body disposal site is in the same area where this guy was working at the time these bodies were dumped.
You know, that, and you're right, that university officer used his spider sense, his instinct, and he was able to do something with it. I want to get into the Stockholm Syndrome thing.
Sure.
And part of your article, and I'm going to quote, it says they conspicuously avoided eye contact with the officer. They had this weird look in their eyes, the female officer said, like brainwashed zombies. We've talked about Stockholm before. Let's talk about it again and apply it to this case.
Yeah, well, as you obviously and many of your listeners know, this refers back to a 1973 bank robbery in Stockholm, Sweden, where one bank robber and eventually law enforcement introduced a friend of his into the bank to try to resolve it. They took three women and a man hostage. They wrapped dynamite around their bodies and held the police off for 6 days in a standoff hostage situation. Well, when it was over and done with and resolved, law enforcement found out that some of the women inside were supporting the two bank robbers. They found out that at least two of the women had performed sexual services for these two guys. One broke off an engagement to become engaged to one of the bank robbers. And law enforcement at that time was saying, hey, what's going on? Is this something planned? Were these women part of it? And what we find out is that, you know, when you're in a terrible, stressful situation, whether you're a hostage, a kidnapped victim, whether you're a PLW, or maybe a battered woman in a terrible relationship, you do what you have to do. Your mind, part of your mind shuts down and says, I will accept this terrible situation because I have to survive. The survival instinct kicks in, and you start to do whatever your captor tells you to do. In essence, there's this bonding that takes place where you feel, if this guy succeeds, if he's successful, if he's not injured or hurt, then I will live, and you start to do what you can to live. And in this situation, this California situation with this young girl who was 11, now she's just within the last couple of days explaining to her daughters by this guy who, you know, by the process of rape, by why her telling her daughters, 11 and 15, that their mother had actually been kidnapped. These little girls never realized it, never knew the whole story. So here we have, you know, a girl at 11 who's never been at school since when she was kidnapped. She has a daughter now her same age when she was taken, as well as a 15-year-old. This whole educational and socialization process is going to take place, and what, you know, what kids in Canada and the U.S. and everybody, every place else learns day after day in school, these kids now somehow are trying to make up 5, 10, 15, 20 years of education and socialization because they've been locked up in this man-made hell in the backyard of this house.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about this. We just have a couple minutes left with Clint Van Zandt here. Let's talk about this Garrido or however you say his name. I was a little disappointed yet somewhat fascinated to hear him in the media. Let's profile a character like this. Obviously, he's out there speaking of brainwashed zombies.
Well, he is. I mean, you know, this is some guy in the 70s who was arrested for a kidnap, a sexual assault. He took his victim to a location that he had set up as a sex house to sexually assault her. He told police at the time that his preference was for violent sex. But this is somebody who's had mental problems for years. I mean, his biological father is suggesting he probably dropped too much acid back in the 60s to 70s, which could be the case.
Yep.
But now you see this mental health illness starting to really become full-blown. The guy's becoming a full-blown psychotic. He's hearing voices in his head. He's got a functional delusional system. You know, but, you know, his wife, who married him when he was in prison at the time for the kidnap rape that he did, I mean, she's part of this. I hold her responsible. And what we're probably going to hear is that she was afraid. She did what the guy told her to do. But, you know, what I'm afraid of, like in the case of Elizabeth Smart, who was kidnapped years ago, her two offenders, her two kidnappers who kept her for almost a year, a husband and wife combination, they've never gone to jail. I mean, they're being held, but they've been found that they just aren't competent to stand trial. I think that may be the case with this Philip and Nancy Girardo, too. The criminal justice system may say they are just so screwed up psychologically that they can't stand trial for this. But Dana, how many other kids are like this? How many other women are like this that are being held in some type of psychological chains that they can't escape? And how many of us living next door have just missed the opportunity to either save them or get the police out to try to save them? That's what worries me.
Exactly. It makes you wonder, and I've been thinking about that myself. Clint, time always goes by so fast. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Clint Van Zandt, former FBI agent, criminal profiler, author. And you can see Clint on MSNBC, the Today Show. He's on TV quite a bit. Why? Well, he's an expert in this kind of stuff. That's it. That's today's show. I appreciate you listening. My name's Dana Pretzer. You can hear us at scaredmonkeysradio.com or scaredmonkeys.com. You can pick up the daily commentary. You can leave comments. You can listen to the show live or podcast, whatever. I appreciate it. We'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.